So thank you very much for the opportunity to speak here. So I mean, there was a certain uncertainty about this talk, as you all have noticed. It was not even clear who is going to give the talk, and there was even a quantum state between the authors that was announced as sort of the speaker. The idea of this talk was we sort of didn't know how this conference will go, and we tried to kind of plan ahead for that. So it was clear to us that when we present our corrector problems, half of the people will have no idea what corrector is, or may have no idea what the corrector is. And so we hope that using a talk like this will clarify what the definition of the corrector is and what the background for this definition is. And that will sort of motivate further interest into the problems that we presented. So this is a report on the joint work with Noam Berger, who is, I guess, not here. I don't see him. It's fine. So very quickly, let me remind you what random walk among random conductance is. So I will always work on the graph ZD, and I'll have edges, and I'll denote the set of edges B, and I don't think I'll use it many times. I'm thinking only of nearest neighbor edges. And then I will generate a sequence of IID random variables, one for each edge, from some law that I call capital P, and the expectation will be denoted by capital E. So these blackboard bold symbols will be used for the expectation with respect to the environment. For the purpose of this slide, I'll assume the condition of uniform ellipticity because it makes the presentation easier at this moment. So I'll assume that the omegas are actually strictly positive with probability 1, even in the sort of stronger sense that that's what the definition of uniform ellipticity is. And then what I do is that now I consider a random walk on the integer lattice, whose law is driven by these conductances. So specifically, the x0, x1, x2 is a Markov chain taking values on the integer lattice, and the transition probabilities are specified here. So you go from x to a neighbor of x with probability that's proportional to the value of the conductance between x and the neighbor, and normalized by the sum of the conductances from vertex x. Okay. So this gives you a well-defined probability, and that's why we, at this moment, I don't want to deal with the situation where some of the omegas can be zero, which will make this definition potentially singular. So I will always think of the initial condition as that I'm starting from a particular point, z, so all of the information is included in these two symbols. The omega tells me what the environment is, z tells me where I start the random walk. So this will be actually the quench law, where for each environment I define a Markov chain. There's also a reason to consider the law of the walk, where I average over the environment, and that's called the annealed law. That's sometimes easier to work with and sometimes harder because I lose the Markov property when I do the averaging. E sub z, ignore that for now. That's a typo. Okay. So this was the uniform elliptic case, but I actually want to look at the situation where some of the omegas may be zero. In fact, what I will do is that I'll allow the probability that omega b is positive, I'll let that be quantity strictly less than 1, but I want that to be quantity bigger than some critical value, and the PC sub d is the critical value for bond percolation on the d-dimensional lattice. And for that, I need that the dB be bigger or equal than 2. So that's one thing. In fact, there's still a lot of omegas lots of distributions you can consider, but the one I'll be primarily concerned with is the one where I put value 1 with probability 1 and value 0 otherwise. Okay, that's sort of the most natural case. That case allows basically an exact mapping into the context of percolation, because now I'm talking about percolation of the bonds where omega b equals 1, and the percolation parameter is exactly p. Okay. So what I have now, I don't have ZD anymore. I have some random subgraph of ZD, which is this set of sites which have a connection to infinity. And fortunately, by Bertin-Keene's theorem, this is a unique cluster. This is a connected set with probability 1. I agree. Yes. Yeah. But it's also true by Bertin-Keene. Yeah, okay, thanks for the correction. You know, we're in the Euclidean setting, so nothing terrible happens here, so don't, okay. So, I want to look at the situation where the origin is in the infinite cluster, because I'll always start the walk at the origin. So I'll only look at the set of environments, which are described by this set omega zero, and I'll, in fact, condition my probability measure on this event. So P sub zero will be the probability that, will be the probability measure condition that the origin is contained in the infinite cluster. Yes? I will not look at that case at all. And there is a slight issue with whatever I'm going to say when the conductances have a non-trivial lower tail near zero. Okay? So what I'm going to say would work with extra sort of notation for the conductances which either take value zero or uniformly bounded away from zero by epsilon. Okay? But we only actually wrote up this particular case because that's the most interesting one. Okay. So what's a question that you may want to ask about such a walk? So if I give you, if I look at the percolation cluster, but I sort of truncate it to an infinite slab like this, then when you start the random walk, you can start asking the question, what's the probability that the walk exits the slab through the top rather than the bottom? Okay, that's a meaningful question to ask. Now, if I worked in the original lattice in ZD, that would be trivially 1/2, because if you start from the origin, the situation is completely symmetrical. And in fact, it's even true for the annealed measure, because the annealed measure preserves the flip symmetry. Okay? So if I give you a cluster, it's inverse through the axis, its reflection through the x-axis is also an infinite cluster. And that will tell me that the probability of exiting through the top is 1/2. Now, but it's not true for the quenched measure, okay? Because I can give you simple configurations for which there's the probability of going through the top is essentially 1. It's very close to 1, okay? So that's sort of a prototype question one might want to ask in this environment and in this situation. And what we will do is that we will address this question by proving much more than just answering this, and that is by proving a scaling limit of the simple random walk on this cluster. So here's a theorem that we will focus on today. So there's lots of writing that is there just to make things complete. So I worked in d bigger equal than 2 and p bigger than pc so that I have an infinite cluster. And I pick omega from the set where the origin is in the infinite cluster. And then I run a random walk with the corresponding law. And then what I do is that I scale space by n and scale time, space by square root and time by n. And what I write here is sort of a piecewise linear interpolation between the values of the random walk. So now you have a continuous function. And you can ask, what's the law of this continuous function in the space of continuous functions on a finite interval? Okay? And the point is that we prove that for almost every realization of the environment, such that the origin is in the infinite cluster, the law of this process converges to an isotropic and non-degenerate bound in motion, and the diffusion constant is, of course, independent of the environment. So the limit law is the same for almost every environment. Okay? Now, this is a statement for one particular version of this random walk. There are actually other versions of the random walk you can consider. For instance, you can consider the lazy walk, where the walk, instead of choosing one of its actual neighbors at random, it simply chooses one of the original 2D neighbors at random and only passes to it if there is a connection to it. Okay, that will be the lazy walk. Or you can think of a continuous time version of this walk, where you would have a continuous time Markov chain, which would have the corresponding transition probabilities. Okay, so I have to give you a very quick overview. So this is the only page where I will try to review existing results, and there are plenty, as you see. So actually, the theorem that I'm stating is new only in dimension 2 and 3. In dimension 4 and higher, it was proved by Vlada Sidorovicius and Alan Snitman. Published in 2004, but I think the preprint was the year before. And But the technique that they use is very different from what we use, and somehow could not, even though we tried very hard, could not be extended to dimensions 2 and 3. Now, the annealed problem was solved way ago, 1989, and the sort of the reason for that was that there was all of this technology which comes from sort of treating the uniform elliptic cases, so particularly the work of Kozlov and Kipnis and Varadan, which is actually where the corrector, as I'm going to define it in a few minutes, was first appeared, or you know, you can trace it back to that. They actually didn't talk about the corrector, I think. Papanikolaou. Yeah, there's plenty of references that I'm leaving, and it's, oh, the definition of the corrector. Okay. Well, I know it from the paper of Kipnis and Varadan. I looked at Papanikolaou and Varadan, and I was not. Well, this paper really was an eye opener for me, I must say. And then sort of there's a new work that the same paper that I'm talking about here proved the uniformly elliptic situation that Robin asked about, but without the possibility of having zeros in the distribution for all dimensions. And there's some new work of Fontes and Mathieu that you may want to look at. Let me not even go into that. And on the other hand, if you look at the directed version of the problem, I mean, the most recent results are due to Rasulaha and Sapalainen, and they have a whole program when they're solving problems even beyond the reversible situation in using the corrector approach. And there is a sort of another independent but very, very deep line of research that I would just call heat kernel estimates. And we have seen some of that in the problems that we discussed on Monday. And it sort of starts with names like Nashvaropoulos, Aronson, and I would just name these three recent works. So these are sort of gradual estimates. These are all for percolation for the situation that I'm talking about. And they sort of gradually improve from diagonal bounds on the heat kernel to even off diagonal bounds. So Martin Barlow's paper is sort of, I think, the state-of-the-art result right now. Okay. Now, so these are the previous results, but there are also simultaneous results. So somehow, as we were finishing this paper, it came to our attention that Mathieu and Piatnitsky are proving exactly the same theorem, and their paper appeared a few weeks after ours basically. However, there's quite some difference between our approach and their approach. There uses homogenization theory, and let me not go more into what the differences are. Okay, so I'd like to give you the main idea of the corrector approach, at the way I see it, which is sort of more geometrical than appeared in the works of Papanikolaou and Varadan and Kipnis and Varadan and so on, which actually deals with sort of the geometry of the infinite cluster very directly. Okay, so if you consider a geometry, so I'm back into my infinite slab situation. So if you consider the geometric embedding of the infinite cluster, then that's not good for our purposes, because when we try to calculate the exit probability, we cannot use the usual martingale technique that we would use if you, for instance, even if you, in the random walk situation, in the random walk on ZD, if I ask the exit probability from that point, probably what you would do is you would set up a martingale and you would sort of use optional stopping theorem and so on. Okay. Now, this doesn't work, and the reason why it doesn't work is that due to the dilution of the graph, the position of the walk on this graph is not a martingale. Okay. Now, we can fix that by changing the embedding of the graph. Okay. So if I consider the following harmonic embedding, and the harmonic embedding is such that the position at, if I look at this side and look at the position of these three neighbors relative to that side, they average to zero. Okay, and if I had non-trivial conductances, they would average to zero when multiplied by the corresponding conductance. Okay, so when I look at this embedding, just let me assume that I have an embedding like that. Then the random walk is interpreted on this new graph is trivially a martingale, and therefore the exit probability, the probability that I exit through the top rather than through the bottom, differs from one by a quantity proportional to the relative vertical shift of the origin compared to the original position. Okay, so just you basically take the relative shift and then you divide it by the width, and that gives you the correction to half in the probability. Okay, so this is by computer. Yeah. Yeah, it actually took a why did you think it was by hand? You don't like my graphics? No, so actually, you know, when we first wrote the code, we were getting pictures where the average quite didn't quite work, and that, you know, so if they look, those look like thrown by hand, but then we fixed the code and it works now. And it's, you know, the way these pictures are, of course, simulated is that I take a very large box and I do the simulation in there. I just truncate the cluster to there. I just freeze the boundary sites, and I do the harmonic deformation, which is a solution to a finite Dirichlet problem. I mean, a Dirichlet problem in finite volume, and then I just show you the part of the cluster which is within these bounds. I don't know. And I don't suppose so, because we just optimize, you know, we're solving the Dirichlet problem, which is a very easy iteration method. Oh, you're not, okay, you mean the embedding is the same?
Yeah,
I suppose so, yeah. But the algorithm that we use is just the usual algorithm for solving the Dirichlet problem. Yeah. Okay, so, What's that? Edges which go from there to there? No. And the reason for that is that so in the plane, at least, when you look at that, so what happens is that if you know these three positions, the side wants to be within the convex hull of the three positions. Okay. I haven't quite proved to myself. I mean, I have no doubt that the resulting graph is planar, but... But you know, you don't see those things, and that actually is a problem that we should have stated, that, you know, once you try to prove that for a general corrector as you go on, you get a planar graph. And it was a general spring embedding of a general graph. Yeah. Right, you can sort of generate the embedding by taking a sequence of volumes that go to infinity. And yes. Are there what? Sorry. No, there's. From now on, we will talk about this embedding most of the time. Right, I will state the theorem in a minute, okay? The embedding is, of course, not unique, because I can always stretch positions and so on and shifts, but actually one of these open problems was that this essentially, the properties that we require make the corrector essentially a unique, the embedding essentially unique, okay? So I just want to set up a notation here. This object is the corrector evaluated at this position, okay? So the corrector will be a function of a position and the random configuration, and here's a theorem which tells you what you can prove, how you can what sort of corrector you can construct. Okay, so I mean this again goes back to all these people, and probably Papanikolaou and Baradan too, I assume. We actually had to work a little bit to convert the uniformly elliptic case to the non-uniformly elliptic case. I mean, just to be sure that everything worked. And what I will give you later on is a presentation of, it's a construction, there's a proof which constructs along the lines that Matthew and Piatnitsky have in their paper, and from what Stefano Ola told me that he has that in some of his lecture notes too. Okay, so there's sort of a approach to that. So let me just give you the properties. So I assume the usual conditions. and I claim that there's a function which takes values, which takes a position, and it takes a percolation, takes a configuration, and outputs a vector for each of them. Okay, and the function has the following property: that for almost every omega, let me just ignore this condition first. You have these three important properties. The first thing is that the function x goes to x plus this corrector is a harmonic function on the infinite component, which is what I want. Okay. The chi itself is a gradient field in the following sense, that if I look at the difference of the chi at position x and at position y for the same omega, I can write it as chi at x minus y at the shifted configuration. Okay. And to make this completely precise, what I've done here is that I have normalized chi to be zero at the origin. Okay, so that shows you how the translation invariant. Otherwise, you would have to sort of write here minus chi of zero of the shifted configuration. And the third important property is that the gradients of chi, again, which I write this way, and I could just drop this because this is zero, but I want you to think of this as a gradient. The gradient squared has a finite expectation for every bond that is present in the graph. Remember that in this measure, the origin is in the infinite component, so once you have a bond to a neighbor, the neighbor is also in the infinite component. Okay? So what you require is this condition, but no information is a priori given about the situation where you have an infinite component which goes high up and then comes back to a neighbor, but there's no direct connection to the neighbor. Okay? So for that, you don't really have any information from this construction. And that's sort of an issue, so we'll have to get that. Get to that later on. Okay, so I think that the present audience actually will be interested in seeing how the proof of the corrector, the existence of the corrector works. So what I've done, I've sort of adapted to my language the proof that it's in Matthieu and Piatnitsky, which at present I think is the most elegant one. The proof of Kipnis and Varadhan, and the one that we use, uses spectral calculus and requires certain calculations that this one avoids. Okay. So here's what you do, is that we will construct the corrector. So since we anticipate the corrector to be a gradient field, it's enough to know the corrector for the neighbors of the origin, okay? Because then you can sort of patch it up using just by going along paths to any point. So that property permits us to limit ourselves to a situation where I actually interpret the corrector as a flow. Okay, so what do I consider is that I take a set of all unit vectors in RD, so these are the vectors to the neighbors of the origin from ZD, and then I consider, I will call a function V which takes a value in omega, and for each edge in this set, and outputs a vector, I will call it the vector field. Okay? And so I want to think of this vector field actually as a flow from the origin to the endpoint of to the neighbor that's marked by the corresponding argument over here. And to maintain certain consistency, I need that the flow from 0 to minus b is the same as the flow from minus b to 0. Sorry, it's the negative of the flow from minus b to 0. Okay? So whatever flows from 0 to its neighbor is the negative of what flows from the neighbor back to 0. So that's a certain consistency condition, and that's there just mostly for the notation, because by looking sort of at both E1 and negative E1, I'm sort of overcounting. I should not have to do that. Okay, so this, but that becomes convenient. Now I can now consider sort of all of these functions, which and endow that with a certain inner product and make it into an L2 space. Okay, and the inner product is as follows, is that you take the vector field along edge B and along edge W, and you take there's a dot actually that is missing. There's supposed to be a dot between those two vectors. These are two vector fields. You multiply it by the corresponding conductance, and then you take you sum over all Bs and you take expectation. Okay, and that defines an inner product, and so all functions for which this expectation is finite, I assemble into this L2 omega cross B space. Okay. Now there are particular vector fields which come from local functions or from functions of configurations omega. Okay. Because if I take any function from omega to RD, okay, I can define a gradient of this function in direction B. So this is a sort of it's a directional derivative rather than the gradient, but then you can assemble these into components of the gradient as just the phi at the shifted configuration minus phi of omega. Okay? So gradient is a natural way how to take a function from omega to RD into a vector field into a function of this type. And there's a natural L2 subspace, which is the subspace of this L2, of this big L2, where I take the gradients of all local functions and I take the L2 closure of them. Yes. Okay, local means that they depend only on a finite number of omegas. Okay? And that's mostly because we don't want to worry about issues like integrability and things like that later on. This will be a sufficient class of functions for us. Okay, and the corrector is essentially based on an orthogonal decomposition or on a projection onto a subspace. Okay, so here's the following fact that you verify by direct calculation. If you take a vector field from the orthogonal complement of this space of gradient fields, then the field satisfies the following condition, that the divergence of the field is zero, divergence being defined by this very natural formula. Okay, so this is the weighted flow from the vertex weighted by these omegas. And therefore, a vector from orthogonal complement, you can think of it as a conserved flow. So there's no flow out of the origin. Okay? Now, if you take a function G, which only depends on the, so this is a vector field, and the vector field assigns edge B, it assigns the value B. Okay, it assigns it the corresponding unit vector. Well, that's a vector function. It's definitely an L2 because it's bounded, in fact. Okay, but it's not a gradient. It's not a gradient field. Okay, it's only gradient field on ZD. But once you sort of take one edge, it will no longer be. Okay, so what you can do is now you take this function, and you project. Actually, it's negative onto the subspace of gradient functions. Okay, you look at the orthogonal projection. And you call that chi, and that defines a certain vector field that we will later on assemble into a corrector. Okay? And the property of this definition now is that when you look, the reason why I took minus g is when I take g plus chi, that's an element of orthogonal complement of the gradient space. And if it's an element of the orthogonal complement, it satisfies this condition, which I can now write explicitly as that. Okay? Mm-hmm. Right. Let me write the formula for you. So if you take a W gradient phi, so if I take an element from the gradient space and take its inner product to the vector, then you can write this as an expectation of phi of omega times divergence of W of omega. Okay. So that's just the usual, and there's a minus sign I think that I'm lying about. Okay. So the point is that if you know that this vanishes for every phi, which is a local function, you know that divergence of W integrates to zero against any local function. But that's only possible if divergence of W is zero almost surely. Okay, so that's the usual identity, that's the usual relation between gradients and divergence. That's why I sort of use this geometrical terminology to describe these. Okay. So that's where this identity comes from. And once I have this formula for this particular choice of my vector field, then what you see is that this essentially is the Laplacian of the purported of the new position in the deformed configuration around zero. Okay, so that tells me that Laplacian zero is zero. So if I now move the neighbors of the origin according to what the chi tells me, I will satisfy the harmonicity condition at the origin. Okay. But now we use the fact that G plus chi is a function which actually obeys the cycle condition, which means that if I integrate the vector field along any path, it's going to be the same for any path. It's going to be independent of the path that I can go. So I can now integrate it into an actual function of a position and omega, okay, using just by adding up things and shifting omega around. And that means that this condition will be therefore satisfied everywhere, and therefore I get... Therefore, I get the harmonic embedding. Yes? Oops. So the reason why it is true is that because it is true for G, and because chi is a gradient, it's a limit of gradient fields. It's a okay? Because chi is a projection of something onto the space of gradient fields, so you can definitely approximate it by gradient fields, and then it will be true. Are you asking whether this space is one-dimensional? That's a good question. Okay, let me try to explain the way I understand the question. The way I understand it is that for what function, so given chi, the question is for what function g you would have a cycle, g plus chi would satisfy the cycle condition on the infinite component. Is that the question? And the answer, you know, the answer is no, because I can add a gradient to it, to a g, a gradient of, you know, I can take a local function on omega the same way I did it here, and I just add it to g, okay, and that would still satisfy the cycle condition. Right. Okay. I think that now you're touching on the, so the point is that if I had two different correctors, okay, then the answer would be no. So I think that this boils down, so the answer to your question would be, well, I forget which way you ask it, but that would be more than just one, the condimension would be more than one, okay, if I had two different correctors there. No, you want, no, sorry, I take it back. You want me to factor out all of the gradient fields. I guess, you know, in that case, I must say, I don't know. So I don't suppose so. This is a non-trivial function which is not an L2 grad that satisfies the cyclic condition. Okay, the question is, are there other independent, what's the dimension of that space once I factor the gradient fields? And the answer is, I don't know if that satisfies you. It's a good question. So you know, remember that g is a vector function which just looks at an edge and just gives you that edge. Okay? So when you now integrate, so what you do is that you now start shifting the omega around. So suppose that you want to go from zero to x, and there, so you'll go along a path, and what you do is that you add the value of g plus chi along the first edge, and then you shift the configuration omega so that it is in the origin, and then you add the other term and so on. Okay? Right, and the point is that G was closed under this operation. It was a closed vector field, so it didn't matter which path I went, and I would still get to this. I would still integrate to the same point, and by the fact that chi is a gradient field, tells me that I will not get into trouble there as well either. So I can integrate this now into a function. Okay. All right. Okay. So, sure. It is in the space L2. It's in the big space. Yeah, because it's, you know, it's a bounded function. So let me remind you what the inner product was. Just look at, if you put G here, what you get is that you get a B dot B, which is order unity, and then you multiply by a quantity of order unity, so all of this adds up to a finite number. Okay. And so, since we got into this, so, you know, one could, of course, extend this construction even to a situation where you would not just look at the nearest neighbors. You can look at sort of any, you know, any collection of neighbors. And for what you need then is that you need that omega b times the length of the bond squared is integrable. Okay? And that's sort of a finite variance condition, which is exactly what you expect to have what you expect to have to put in if you want to get out the CLT. Okay, so it's a very natural, this is a very natural condition to look at. Okay, are we done with the corrector? Everybody happy? So this is a construction. Of course, one could think of other constructions. For instance, one would be is that you would solve the Dirichlet problem in a finite box, and you would try to take the limit. Okay, we don't know that the limit exists, and we don't know that what you get is translation invariant in an appropriate sense. Okay, because you break translation invariance. So what we know, there's another definition that you can do, is that you can... I think I agree that we actually know that for this, because we can represent this definition using a stopping problem. So this definition is embedded in a larger class of definitions that you can consider, so that you take a random walk and you let it run in the environment until it, say, hits the boundary of the box that would coincide with that. Or you devise some other stopping rule for which you can take the limit as events going the time to infinity. And now you run these two random walks with the same stopping rule from two different points of the graph, okay? And you subtract the expectations. And what we can show is that for sort of reasonable stopping rules, these two converge to the corrector, okay? The difference of these two converges to the corrector again. So a posteriori we can prove, but we actually need the spectral calculus for this. I don't know how to do this using this projection approach directly. Okay, so using spectral calculus we can represent things and get that done. Okay, so let me tell you how you use the corrector to finish the proof of the main theorem. So first thing is that we have when I look at the deformed random walk, which is the random walk on the deformed graph. And so the position of the walk is xn plus the corrector at that position, okay? And by definition, this is a martingale. And due to the properties that we had before, the L2 integrability of the corrector, you can actually ensure that it's an L2 martingale, okay? Remember that the corrector could have stretched certain bonds quite a lot, so it's not, each bond was stretched only by a finite amount. So if you look at, by L2 martingale, I mean L2 martingale in the sense that this expectation is finite, okay, if you wish. So that's actually what I need. So the ergodic theorem tells me that that when I look at this condition, which is one of the principal conditions in the Lindenberg-Feller-Martingale CLT, that this will converge as n tends to infinity to this expectation, okay? And that has to do with the fact that as the walk moves around, okay, the law, so this will be true for the lazy walk. So if I change my definition of the walk to the lazy walk, the law P naught is a stationary distribution for the Markov chain on environments induced by this random walk. Okay, that's why the lazy walk is sort of the good thing to work with, because normally you need to sort of modify the distribution by changing the by multiplying by the degree of the origin, say. Okay, so we don't have to do it in that case, which is just a minor thing. So once you know that, then the Markov chain on environments has a stationary ergodic distribution, and then this is the statement that the averages squared of the Markov chain converge to their expectation. So this is just the ergodic theorem for Markov chains. Okay, and once I have this condition and it's sort of its corresponding variants that are required by the Lindenberg-Feller-Martingale CLT, what you conclude is that the linear interpolation of these values properly scaled converges to Brownian motion. So that's good. So now we know, we understand the, yes. I was wondering about that. So this is the guy who crossed the Atlantic by plane. And he proved the theorem while doing that. Yeah, so it's Lindberg? Linderberg. Okay. Okay. So what this gives us is it gives us the theorem, but on a graph that we were not interested in the first place. I mean, we are interested in it after all, but... So what we have to do is we have to see how much the deformation changed the path of the corresponding random walk and see that change is negligible on the diffusive scale. Okay? And that's actually really the crux of the matter. Up to now, you could say that we pretty much took everything that was already in the literature and modified it appropriately. So this is really the crux of what our proof boils down to. So we need to show that if you look at, so in ideal situation, what you would like to show is that if you simply take the maximum deviation of the walk on the deformed graph from the walk on the original graph, which is marked by this maximum of the corrector along that path, for up to time n, scales like a little o of squared of n. Okay, that's what you would like to show. And so it will be enough to prove this in probability, actually. Okay. So, however, we already know that the deformed random walk, the martingale, is order root n. And then with a little bit of work, you can convert that to the statement that you that you only therefore need to look at the position of the walk within the box of radius of size squared of n. Okay, so what we will actually prove is the following theorem, a proposition, is that if you look at the corrector, and now what I'm going to do is I'm going to replace all squares of n by n, so that I don't have these squares around. So when you go from here to there, replace all of the squares of n by n. So when I look at the maximum of the corrector anywhere in a box of size n, then it scales sublinearly with n. Okay, so when I divide it by n, the limit is zero. So that's sort of the whole issue. So to prove that, let me I have to actually speed up a little bit. So let me give you some ergodic theory, which is very quick. So what I will first look at, I'll look at the situation along the x-axis. Okay, I'll try to prove that this theorem is true along the x-axis. I'll restrict the maximum of the corrector to the x-axis. So for that, I mark the intersection of the infinite cluster with the x-axis. This is a double infinite sequence, and I order these intersections increasingly. And I put x naught to be the one at the origin because that's what I always assume. Now, if I look at the shift, which is the inducement, is the shift induced on the infinite cluster by the operation that I simply take the infinite cluster and move it so that the next intersection falls back to the origin, then this defines a certain shift on my configuration space, and it's not hard to believe that it actually preserves the measure, the conditional measure. And it's in fact ergodic with respect to. I'm in dimension, any dimension bigger or equal than 2. There's nothing about the walk. This is a statement about percolation configurations. Okay, so I'm looking at I take a percolation configuration. Let me just give you a sketch of that. I intersect it with the x-axis. Here's my origin, and here are my sides x0, x1, x2, and so on. And what the shift does is that if this was the origin, it just takes the configuration and shifts this side to be the origin. Okay? And that preserves the distribution, and it actually is an ergodic shift for that distribution. Okay? Now, why do we care? Is that if I now take a function, which is the corrector evaluated at this point over here, okay? And I'm going to again write this to remind you that the corrector is a gradient, so I can think of it as the difference of the corrector at site x1 omega and at the origin. Then you can write the quantity that you care for, which is the corrector at the end point on that axis, an nth intersection on that axis, as a telescoping sum, okay, where you look at this gradient and you just add the shifts thereof. Well, if I now divide by n, what I get on the right-hand side is something that you can apply ergodic theorem to. So what you need is you need some conditions. You need that the psi function is in L1, and that you can prove, but it's not completely straightforward. Mind you that what we know is that if this h is here, okay, that the difference of the corrector along these two points is in L2. But I don't know that if this h is not here, then the only way I know the corrector over here is that I go along certain paths from that point to that point, and I just integrate the differences. Okay. Fortunately, the path cannot be very long because Antal and Pistora proved is that it has sub-exponential tails that destroys the L2, but it gives me L2 minus epsilon for every epsilon, and definitely gives me L1. Okay. So now I know that this function is an L1. I also want to remind you that the corrector, this is just about the corrector. The corrector was a limit of gradient fields. Okay, because it's in L2 grad, so it's in a closure of the, okay. And the gradient fields will be such that if you now write a gradient field and use a shift, then the gradient field will integrate to zero. Okay? So that shows you that the expectation of the psi function is zero, and that shows you that this guy divided by n will converge to zero almost surely. And that's the content of this corollary. Okay? So that proves the previous proposition, the one which I have here along the coordinate axes, but now I have to take care of the other dimension, okay, which I've ignored so far. Okay. So in order to do that, I will define a concept of good lines and good sides. Okay. So I say that the side is good. Okay. Let me first say when the origin is good. The origin is good if the corrector is bounded everywhere by this quantity on the x-axis. Okay. That's when the x-axis is good. So that's when the line is good. Okay. And in general, what you say is that a side is good if the side is in the infinite cluster, okay? And both the horizontal line through that side and the vertical line through that side is good along this definition. Okay? Yes? Now I'm in dimension two. Yeah, but not more than dimension two. Okay? Right. This definition and the proof that I gave using the corrector behavior of the corrector on lines, that works in any dimension. Okay, but now what I'm trying to do is I know how the corrector grows on lines, but I don't know how to get to a general point yet. And so what I'm giving you is the arguments that will allow you to go from the origin to a general point in the infinite cluster. Okay, and the argument that I'm going to give you is purely two dimensional. Okay. Okay, so here's your two-dimensional box. So observe two properties that if I make k sufficiently, given omega, if I make k sufficiently large, the origin is good. Okay? And that's the consequence of the fact that the corrector decreases sublinearly along the axis. So if I take k sufficiently large to take care of sort of the finite number of sites where that bound fails, that will work. Okay? So it's good. So both of the x-axis and the y-axis are good. And now if I look at any point over here, then I can say, if I look at the x-axis, I can start counting the number of horizontal lines, number of points on the x-axis. I somehow didn't draw these crosses right. So the number of points on the x-axis, which are good sites, okay? Which will tell me that not only the x-axis is good viewed from that point, but also the corresponding vertical line is good viewed from that point. Okay? And the important thing is that since goodness is a property that appears with positive probability for the origin, these lines will appear with this in a box. I expect to see the largest distance between the consecutive good lines will be order a little O of n, okay? Because they have a positive density. Okay, so now I want to put this together to complete the argument. They're not independent, but I'm using translation invariance here. Okay, so I know that there's a positive density of good sites, and you can easily verify that if you have an epsilon n break between them, then the density would jump as you go along these, you know, it would jump by a factor, say, 1 over 1 minus epsilon, and that's not possible in the limit. So eventually these things have to grow sublinearly. Okay. So first let me look at the good grids that I have, this grid of good lines. So if I pick a point here, I can always relate the, I know this is a good side. Let me just say that this is a good side. Okay. So what I can do is that I can, okay, this is a, the intersection of the y-axis is good. So if I want to look at arbitrary point in the infinite cluster over here, and I look back to this point, I know that the difference of the corrector between those two points obeys the k plus epsilon n bound. And the same thing I know about the origin and these two sides. Okay, so what I know is that if I now look at the difference between the corrector here and at that point, I can definitely bound it by 2k and 2 epsilon plus 2 epsilon n. So that gives me the control of a corrector on a grid. And the question is, how do I interpolate for the sides in between? Because I have plenty of inference cluster in between. Okay, well, in two dimensions, and that's really what makes this argument two-dimensional, you can use harmonicity of the object x plus the corrector. Okay, because if I want to know the value of the corrector at this point, the fact that x plus the corrector is harmonic tells me that the value of the function x plus the corrector is dominated by the values on the boundary, by the maximum principle. Well, That doesn't mean, a priori, that doesn't mean that chi hasn't changed by a lot, but it could only have changed by so much that x has changed. Okay? But I know that x could not change by more than a sublinear factor because the distance between the lines is little of n. So when you put all of this together, you find out that the maximum of the corrector anywhere in the box of size n is bounded by 2k plus 2 epsilon s plus little of n. And if you're wondering what that little of n is, it's the maximum distance between these good lines. And so if I divide this by n and let n go to infinity and epsilon to 0, I prove the dilemma. Okay, so that proves the theorem in two dimensions. Unfortunately, this argument won't work in three dimensions because even if I have a very dense grid of sides, of lines, in all three directions, I can always get out sort of through the sides of the corresponding rectangular boxes that they mark down. Okay? And therefore, in three dimensions, one has to do something less explicit. So this is somewhat an embarrassing fact that we don't know how to extend this maximum bound to dimensions 3 and higher. So in three dimensions, we know how to prove a statement which is sort of less strong. So if you count the number of sites where the corrector is bigger than epsilon n in a box of size n, then there's a less than a volume of them, okay, a little over the volume. So that's the proposition. I'm going to skip the proof of this proposition. So there's an induction on volume which goes by this argument. I'll be happy to return to it if you want me to. So once I have that proposition in the place, we sort of use this pretty standard approach to these things, is that we use the fact that Martin Barlow's estimates, in fact just the upper bound, gives us a tightness for the corresponding linear interpolation of the random walk as a continuous process. Okay, so we have a tightness bound. So if you need to show convergence to Brownian motion, it's enough to show convergence of finite dimensional distributions. And by the Markov property, it's enough to show that the endpoint distribution converges to appropriate Gaussian. Okay? But from proposition 6, we know is that if I look, and this bounds as well, I know that when I look at the corrector at the endpoint, at point xn, and I scale it by root n, then so this tells me that the distribution of xn is pretty smeared out over the box of size squared of n. And therefore, I'm unlikely to be at the sites where the corrector is big. Okay? So in probability, you prove that this tends to zero in probability. And since what that gives you is that xn is actually just a martingale plus a correction over one. And since we already proved that this martingale converges to Brownian motion, then we know the convergence of the endpoint distribution to Gaussian, and that gives you the convergence of that. Okay? So this is how you sort of patch things together. I mean, it's not an unreasonable proof, but it's less elegant than what we have in two dimensions, and therefore there is a certain desire to improve the two-dimensional argument to higher dimensions as well. But we were not able to do it. Yes? Mm-hmm. No, I mean what Yuval is suggesting is we try this, because what we know about the corrector using the good lines argument is we have a certain dense grid. Okay? And for what you would like to do is that you'd like to start the walk at the origin, say at the point where you want. Okay. But why is it?
The weights are bounded by a constant, right?
Yeah, okay, let me, yeah, I think that you actually are right. Yeah. Okay, so let me just finish with a few things that go sort of in various directions that you want to generalize this problem. So while Yuval may have just proved the maximum bound on the corrector in D bigger or equal than 3, but so that, you know, that's there really for aesthetic reasons, that we would like to have a proof that tells you more, and we would like to, as well, we'll argue, we would like to know more about the corrector anyway. So, but there are other sort of generalization of the process that you might want to look at. So for instance, you might want to try to understand what happens on other graphs which don't originate from ZD. Okay, and a typical situation would be, say, Voronoi percolation or anything that comes from a point process in RD. Okay. I actually have a student who works on this, so I should not give away this problem so lightly. Everybody else is welcome to touch every other problem. Okay. There is a variant of this walk. As I said, you can consider walks which go sort of beyond the nearest neighbor structure, and you can even have sort of a non-trivial power law distributions of these connections. So if you consider a long-range percolation with power law decaying probabilities of connecting to faraway sites, then what you have, you get ostensibly a very large graph, okay? And you can make it such that the condition of the second moment of the jump distribution is infinite, okay? And in that case, what you expect is that the walk will actually not scale to Brownian motion, but will scale to stable law in there, okay, stable process. And there's also some work which is recent by Jean-Dominique Deutschel, and I think independent of Mathieu has something, where you can sort of generalize the notion of environment into non-reversible environments using the loop using a certain loop representation. So there may be potential in this whole business to solve a certain little portion of the random walk and random environment subject. Now, as far as the corrector is concerned, I'd like to argue that it's interesting. We've argued a lot, so let me just restate the two problems that me and Noam have talked about. Is the question is, do we have a uniqueness of a corrector in a more general sense, which boils down to the question, do I have non-trivial, sublinear, non-constant harmonic functions on the infinite cluster? Okay. And another question is the question of a scaling limit. How does the corrector scale as you go far away? And I have a heuristic calculation which says that the scaling is a Gaussian free field in 2 dimensions, and in 3 and higher dimensions, we actually expect that the corrector is tight. Okay. And there's an interesting question, what happens to the corrector and all of this proof when you let P goes to PC, because there should be a crossover to non-trivial critical behavior in that case. Now, and I'd like to finish these talks by giving you some pictures. Okay. So this is percolation on a 50 by 50 grid. The probability is 0.95. So you see no side is missing from here. Yet the corrector clearly sees the non-trivial connected dual components. Okay, and as you decrease P, the holes become sort of larger and larger, and of course eventually the picture becomes slightly unreasonable, because 50 by 50 grid is not big enough to sort of capture the actual behavior of the corrector. So this is for 0.55. You see that everything is along a few strands. It's like when you tear a stocking. What happens. Okay, thank you very much.